This is The Best of Our Knowledge, a presentation of National Productions.
Today's college students are paying 21st century dollars for a 19th century education. That's according to a new book by an expert in educational innovation. She says colleges and universities have been operating by the same educational template for well over a century.
Pretty much everything we know about contemporary education, higher education, comes from that time. Majors, minors, grades, entrance exams, electives, specialization, graduate school.
Today on The Best of Our Knowledge, we'll hear a discussion about how to revolutionize the university and prepare students for a world in flux. We'll also spend an academic minute trying to figure out what it means to be a successful college student. I'm Bob Barrett, and this is The Best of Our Knowledge. Kathy N. Davidson thinks college students are getting a raw deal. That includes the 21 million enrolled today, the ones who are on their way, and the much-maligned millennials who have graduated in the last decade. Davidson says the schooling they are receiving was developed in the late 19th century to train farmers and shopkeepers to become factory workers and office managers. And she says that worked pretty well for most of the 20th century. But now, in the post-industrial, post-internet world, change needs to happen. Kathy Davidson is a lifelong educational innovator and instigator. After 25 years as a professor and administrator leading innovation at Duke University, Davidson moved to the City University of New York in August of 2014 to direct the Futures Initiative at the Graduate Center of CUNY. She talks about those needed changes in her new book, The New Education, How to Revolutionize the University to Prepare Students for a World in Flux. She spoke about her book and those changes with The Best of Our Knowledge's Joe Donahue.
What got you thinking that we needed a new university?
Well, I've been teaching in the old one for a long time, and more I was feeling like there was a misfit between the kinds of things that students need to know to survive and thrive in this world and the kind of educational system we are offering them. And many of the people who are saying they're educational reformers were just saying things that I absolutely knew from my joint role in Silicon Valley as well as an educator that are just not what CEOs are asking of young employees today. So I really started doing research into the history of higher education and talking to people who are great innovators now, and also talking to employers who are looking ahead to the future of their companies and talking about the kinds of things they most need and the skills they most need in students today.
In looking at that history, obviously a question could be what makes the higher education system that we have now out of date. But was it ever in date? Was it ever on top of things and had it right, in your opinion, in looking at that history?
Well, I don't know about having it right or not because I didn't live in 1890. But basically between about 1860 and 1925, America, and I'm going to focus specifically on America, although this is also happening in Europe. America goes through what we all know from our high school history classes, industrialization, migration, and urbanization. Massive changes to the world, and whole new kinds of professions were being invented. But at the time, you could basically go from a high school diploma to dentistry or medical or law school without even going through college. College, you took a complicated Latin translation test that really didn't prepare you for the world of the Model T and the telegraph. So Charles Eliot, who was would go on to become the president of Harvard for 40 years, wrote a manifesto called The New Education, which was about how out of step 19th century education was with the new industrialization of the time. And pretty much everything we know about contemporary education, higher education, comes from that time. Majors, minors, grades, entrance exams, electives, specialization, graduate school, professional school, requirements, accreditation, rankings. So pretty much the whole infrastructure of modern education was designed to professionalize new professional managerial class for this world of the new corporation, the new industrial age. Well, we know about deindustrialization. And the kinds of corporations that we have today are very different than the ones that existed in 1890. But we're still working from a system that focuses on extreme, rigid specialization in fields that look pretty much the way they did in the 1920s.
So is it the structure that needs to change first, or are you able to take that major, minor, and the different forms of the structure that we have now and update them?
I actually think it all needs to be updated, from how we actually teach our classes, the different ways we learn and measure learning, to the Board of Trustees and the kinds of issues that people running our universities, presidents and Board of Trustees, see as the mission of the university. In some cities, I wonder if universities are about real estate or about learning. Some of our universities now are small global economies. And is that the priority for education? And what kinds of priorities do we need today? In the classroom, we've come up with a system, again, invented in the 19th century, of high energy, high stakes, end of grade testing. Everything rests on the final exam, maybe in some advanced classes on the research paper, but especially on the final exam and on the GPA. We've got so much research that shows that students gear up to take a final exam and then forget things just about as quickly as they learned them. There's got to be better ways, and there are better ways of learning that actually can be applied beyond the final exam to the rest of your life. And that's basically what I advocate in the new education, not a system that's designed for graduation requirement and for a diploma, but what happens after you have that diploma and how you use it in the rest of your life outside of education.
In reading the book, you make the case that really everyone is involved in making these changes: students, educators, the universities themselves.
Exactly. The vision of a higher education is a vision of society. So just as the industrial age created a new kind of education, we need one too. Like, what do you do in a world where your profession could be outsourced or driven by AI or some new kinds of technology overnight? I mean, how many professions have been changed radically in the last two decades? How do you learn in a way that helps you not only be a subject to change, but maybe somebody who can actually actively make change and make change in their own life? How do you train not for something that's stable, but for something that is by definition unstable? These are all the kinds of active, engaged learning that are often known as progressive learning, and in fact, go all the way back to the same period as Eliot. At the same time that Eliot is talking about a prescriptive, specialized, professionalized education, John Dewey and W.E.B. Du Bois are saying, no, 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 we have to educate the whole citizen. We're in a democracy. We're all in this together. It's not just about jobs. It's also about how you live in society. I'd like to say it's easy to make someone workforce ready for their first job. How do you make them world ready? How do you make them ready for changes that we know are going to happen in their lifetime? A student who graduates today could well be retiring in 2070. Now, I can't tell you what the world is going to be like in 2070, but I know it's not going to look like a history major or even a computer science major, especially not a computer science major today.
So what does that tell us that student needs to do now? What can they do to make the most out of their education?
I think the most important thing they can do, I like to say, make your major minor. Since so many majors are very, very prescriptive, I believe you should get them, you know, the general idea is you get the general education courses out of the way and concentrate on the real stuff in your major. I kind of think we need to flip that. We need to improve general education so it really is designed to help prepare students for this world. So, for example, I think some kind of defensive driving on the internet course is necessary for all of us. What does it mean to crunch data? What is fake news? How do fake news generate real news that is often then turns out to be fake or misleading? What happens to your own privacy? What happens to your own data? So that's one kind of general education. I also think the specialized, we have way too many requirements for a major, and that college is the one place where students can really explore and find out what they want to do. Most students go into a major and then end up in a career that may or may not suit them, but they really don't even know what that career is. Another feature of the new education is experiential learning, some ways where you're actually interning with a program, finding out how you can apply your own major to the larger world, and doing things that really give you a sense of what the work world is like, but also what the social world is like out there, and helps prepare you for that. One of the students I interviewed for the book said, how come no one gives you a course in how to be an adult 101? And I think in some ways that might be the most important course that an 18 to 22-year-old, a conventional college student, might take now, is adult 101.
Are students able in some way, at least in some way, to achieve many of these goals under the system that they're currently going to school under?
You know, I'm an optimistic person, so I didn't want to write a book that was only critique. So I give lots of models, and at the end, I end with 10 ways that any professor can change a classroom and from an old education to the new education. And I also give 10 ways that any student can take their education at any school and figure out how to make it as creative, as useful, as important to them as possible. One of the things I've done with my students is very simple. I have them write the first week of class, especially if I'm teaching first-year students, I'll have them write a kind of idealistic resume of what they want from their life and what they've already done to get towards those goals and what they think they need to do, and then tell them to put together an actual resume of their preparation so far and to make that be something they constantly are checking against. What we know from cognitive psychology, my last book was on cognitive psychology, and what we know is we're very good at forgetting how we change. So it's really useful to make a baseline for yourself of your own goals and your own qualities so you know how you're improving, you know how you're learning, you know how close you're getting to those goals. It's really easy to feel like a failure when you don't meet them and to just absorb your successes and not even realize that you've accomplished as much as you have. So that kind of baseline helps guide you and inspire you, allow yourself to inspire yourself through your own education. And you can do that at any college. Another rule is treat college like a year abroad, where you think of it as the most exciting thing you can do, especially if your college offers some low stress forms like pass-fail grades. Take that class that you know that you're going to get a C in, if only to see how people who get A pluses in that class think in the world. Because at some point you're going to be in a workplace where you're working with people who see the world totally different than you do, who just don't understand the things you understand, but who understand things that you can't even fathom. College is a great place to really get to experience what makes people tick. And that is a life-saving skill.
Still to come, Joe Donahue's conversation with Kathy Davidson continues with a look at this question: can we make these changes and still afford to pay for college? That's next on The Best of Our Knowledge. Got any questions or comments about The Best of Our Knowledge? Send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. And if you'd like to listen to this or any past programs again, you can find them online at our flagship station's website. Go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. And while you're there, subscribe to The Best of Our Knowledge's podcast or download the WAMC radio app to listen on demand anytime, anyplace. This is The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. Our guest today is Kathy Davidson, director of the Futures Initiative at the Graduate Center of the City University of New York. She's talking about her new book, The New Education, How to Revolutionize the University to Prepare Students for a World in Flux, with The Best of Our Knowledge's Joe Donahue. He brought up what he calls the elephant in the room, the cost of college.
Cost is, to me, one of the most diabolical things that's happening in higher education. Almost everybody who's a parent of a college-age student, if they were fortunate enough to go to college, they went to college under a social system that really believed in education as a public good and where education was affordable. One study showed that if you were a Yale student a generation ago, if you worked 4 hours a day, you could put yourself through Yale without tuition debt. Today, it would take 17 hours a day working at current wage rates to have the same result. Clearly, that's not possible. We have a very, very huge differential system where private education more and more is for the 1%. That was not true a generation ago, and that's a social issue. We have to think about that. Do we really want our universities to be country clubs that also have education attached, science centers that also have undergraduate education attached, or do we want them to be elite universities for the 1%? In which case, then they are like other luxury goods, and that price is not an issue. But we're making a social choice to offer all that bounty to the 1%. The more tragic thing is our public educational systems. University of Colorado now gets 3% of its funding from the state of Colorado. That's criminal. You're robbing the future for those students. They're paying too much tuition. Colorado then has to get students from other states who pay out-of-state tuition or other countries to pay out-of-state tuition to make its own bottom line. It has to get federal grants, which are now drying up like crazy. and it defers most of its costs onto its students, who then have to make very cautious choices in college because they know when they graduate, they're not just looking for a future, they're already paying off a debt. It's a terrible, terrible thing that we as a society must address. And as I said, the parents of students today complain about it. Those parents actually went through an educational system that was designed with education as a public good. There have been many, many tax revolts, so-called tax revolts, that have robbed our children of their future.
So let me get back to the germ of the question, which is, can we do it in the sense of, can we revolutionize the university? Can we change the very core, as you're suggesting in the book, at an affordable cost?
I think we can, and it depends. You know, it's, again, different depending on your audience, depending, you know, if you're Harvard, you might not need to change the cost structure because you might be doing just fine for the students that you're serving. If you're a public university, we have to think about reinventing the public university. And interestingly, a number of states, New York, Tennessee, Oregon, and there's rumors about California, are now starting to say there should be no cost tuition for students or graduated tuition costs based on possible income. That's a real redistribution of the state's revenues back towards college. Some people say if we got rid of the three strikes rules and minimized our prison population, we could put that money to public education. Famously, the state of California has flip-flopped. Used to pay one percentage for prisons and another for higher education. It flipped so that now we're paying about 10 times more for prisons than for higher education, and that could flip again. You know, these are big social issues and social choices that we could all work towards together. Some are idealistic. Some we can do tomorrow in our classrooms. All of them takes, as you said, students, faculty, administrators, policymakers, and even presidents to make these changes.
And I'm sorry to belabor this point. I'm just trying to get a sense of, are we doing enough, even in changing the way we teach and having the students get more out of an education that can make those bills lower and realize, as you say, that is really the albatross around the neck, because students are now coming out. You talked about the generation before of being under a much different system. Well, the students coming out now are looking at themselves and saying, is this worth it?
Right. Well, it's about a $40,000 per student on average debt right now. And a lot depends on, again, public versus private. In public education, there's a direct correlation between the lack of money coming into the system from the public coffers and how much education costs. And now about one out of every two classes at our universities are taught by adjunct faculty member. That's the equivalent of an Uber driver working on contract, just being paid to teach a class. So these are way underpaid, even below minimum wage if you calculate hours spent in a classroom, adjunct laborers. So the problem is not on that end. The problem is the revenue coming in. And if the revenue is being deferred to the student rather than to society at large, then tuition is going to continue to go up. As I've said, there are states that have decided to make those commitments to make a change, New York, Oregon, Tennessee, and start lowering tuition or even ending tuition costs. So that's very optimistic. But again, that's a social change, not just a cost-cutting change, but a social change. There are ways to cut costs, and I talk about all the ways in the book that people have talked about cutting costs. Most of those are pretty marginal and really, really require a different funding structure. As with any business, the cost of the product partly depends on how much you put into the manufacturing of that product, and you have to think about revenue streams. And either the revenue stream is coming from one place or another. Right now it's coming from students' pockets.
You mentioned the word optimism a moment ago. So you are optimistic that we can change it. What do you think the timeline, or what do you think a rational timeline is to slowly start to turn the ship around?
Well, you know, I never thought when I started writing this book 3 years ago that three states would be offering free tuition. That to me would have been completely contrary to the whole direction that the country was going in, and one of those states being Tennessee, not even a blue state. You know, so this is not socialism. This is, Tennessee deciding it needs to offer its students free tuition. So I've given up making predictions. No one predicted Uber. No one predicted Amazon. No one predicted free tuition. We live in a time when there's lots of unpredictability. But again, if faculty wanted to, within the structure we have now, change how they teach students, that can happen. I'm also very encouraged by things like, to use an elite example, the history department at Yale decided it was silly to have history be a pre-professional major, since only a very small percentage of its students were going on to graduate school to be history professors. So they now have two history majors, one for that professionalized student, one for anybody who thinks, wow, in this complex world, I need to understand global histories and how we got here before I can figure out where we're going to, the old cliche about history. They changed their history major. History is now, once again, the number one major at Yale because, in fact, it makes sense in this complex modern world that you do need to know history. Interestingly, the American Historical Association says 123 history programs are impressed not only by what Yale is doing, but themselves have signed on to rethink their history program. Now, that's just one field and one discipline in one school, but there's 122 other ones that are looking at changing their major, too. So, I'm on the one hand pessimistic about change. On the other hand, I think we all know we need some educated citizens right now. I think we all know that the world is too complex to be stupid and that we all need more knowledge, more background, more grounding in order to pilot this world towards a saner, sustainable future.
Again, the name of Kathy Davidson's new book is The New Education, How to Revolutionize the University to Prepare Students for a World in Flux. She spoke with the best of our knowledge's Joe Donahue. So just what does it mean to be a successful college student today? That's the topic of today's Academic Minute.
The path to success for college students is a well-traveled one. Graduate and find a good-paying job. I'm Dr. Lynn Pascarella, president of the Association of American Colleges and Universities. And today on the Academic Minute, Tricia Seifert, associate professor of adult and higher education at Montana State University, explores whether a different path might be needed in the future.
In the U.S., we tend to use a fairly linear definition of college student success, exemplified by the two C's in the word. The first C is completion, specifically degree completion. Students succeed when they graduate, and colleges and universities succeed when they graduate students. The second C is cash from a well-paying job. In this definition, success is completely linear. Completion leads to cash. But when I interviewed students about their definition of success, it wasn't so linear. Students want to graduate with high grades and get a good job, but they also want to learn how to take risks and rise to challenges. It was through these conversations that I realized the common definition of college success limits students and deprives them of the true value of their education. So here's my proposal. It moves from a linear definition of success to one that is cubic. The first C is for curiosity. Students are successful when they want to know and push boundaries. Pushing boundaries calls on students to think, but more importantly, act creatively. Engaging one's curiosity and creativity requires students to be open to their life's calling. Completion to cash sings a siren song. It takes a great deal of courage to listen and embrace one's calling. But when they do, students are rewarded not with a job, but with a career, meaningful work that is personally fulfilling and enriches their community. And community is a core value of higher education, which from its very inception was intended to benefit the public good. Together, curiosity, creativity, calling, courage, career, community form something greater, something more complex than the linear definition of success. They capture the value and promise higher education holds for students and society.
That was Tricia Seifert of Montana State University. You can find this, other segments, and more information about the professors at academicminute.org.
The Academic Minute is a production of WAMC, Northeast Public Radio, in partnership with the Association of American Colleges and Universities. That's all the time we have for this week's program. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at our flagship station's website. Go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. While you're there, subscribe to our podcast or any of the other WAMC or National Productions podcasts. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. And you can find us on Twitter at @TBOOKnowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. Be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Best of Our Knowledge.
Bob Barrett is producer of The Best of Our Knowledge. Dr. Alan Chartok is executive producer. The Best of Our Knowledge is a production of WAMC Radio's National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Hear more at WAMC.org.